Hello, people can hear me?
Okay, so we're gonna get started over here. As we've seen, we've sort of been going chronologically through the day of the 14th of Nisan. We're now at the actual sacrifice of the Korban Pesach. We had various notes about how it interacts with the regular sacrifice that happened every night and the other various tasks that happen in the temple and the intention behind the sacrifice. The Pesach requires the right intention throughout, though that's not necessarily the case of other sacrifices, and so on and so forth. So now we're just going to continue along in our path of describing the temple service. I just wanted to say one methodological thing, actually, about the last Mishnah. I want to talk about this because one of the odd things about reading an oral text from 2,000 years ago is that the only way you can really understand it sometimes is through the commentaries, and you know nothing else other than what they tell you, because the words themselves can be quite unclear. So, for example, here, where it says "Hashochet et haPesach al haChametz over v'lo taaseh," I explained it last time according to the commentators, as you can see in the brackets on Safaria, that al haChametz means you have chametz in your possession and you came to slaughter your Pesach. So I just wanted to say that may be, in fact, the actual pshat of the Mishnah. That might be indeed what the Mishnah means, but it's a weird way to say it. This al haChametz literally just means the Pesach on the Chametz. And I just was reading next week's Parsha. It just seemed to me that the text of the Torah uses similar language to talk about bringing sacrifices with chalot matzot b'lulot b'shemen. Right, al zevach hatodah shel shavuot. So fine, so it's on top of. But I just wonder whether there's some other reading of Mishnah out there which would take this literally, that there's some kind of actual chametz on the altar. Now, I don't want you to take this too seriously. What I'm mainly saying is that sometimes you just need to be aware of all the words you need to add into the Mishnah in order to make it make any sense. So I added a whole framework onto this Mishnah. We'll probably see another one later on, which also requires a sort of a new framework to understand it. And that might, in fact, be what the Mishnah always meant, but you always got to be wary when you see a Mishnah that you can't understand the literal words without an entire framework of interpretation. Okay, now we're going to tell the story about what happened during temple times. HaPesach nishchat b'shlosh kitot. The Pesach was slaughtered in three groups. Shne'emar v'shachatu oto kol kahal adat Yisrael. Kahal v'idah v'Yisrael. So when it tells us that we should slaughter the Pesach, it says in the Torah that they slaughtered it to the entire assembly of the community of Israel. Community of the assembly of Israel. So that's three different words to describe the community of Israel. There's Kahal, Eidah, and Yisrael. So because of those three different words, you know there should be three groups of people going into sacrifice their Pesachs. What I would say about this is that it seems to me that probably they needed three groups because the temple didn't have enough room for everyone to slaughter the Pesach. And this is like a nice scriptural hook where you can sort of put the already pre-existing practical practice. Also, yeah, people talk about how the Mishnah rarely quotes the Torah, so it's funny to see when the Mishnah does. The truth of the matter is the Mishnah quotes the Torah more than people say it does, but nonetheless, this seems to be a case where they like quote a scriptural anchor for a otherwise pre-existing practice that was probably set in motion for practical purposes. Now we're going to describe the procedure of each group. Nichnasa chat harishona, nitmaleita azara, na'alud latot ha'azara. When the first group came in, they would fill up the temple courtyard and then they would lock the doors of the courtyard afterwards, so in order to not, you know, allow people to pack in too much. Then taku heri v'taka'u, they would blow the shofar. So that seems to be tekiya and then trua and then tekiya. The longer blast, the short blast, and the longer blast. The Mishnah doesn't have shvarim. The Mishnah only has tekiya and trua. But the hariyah is also a little ambiguous word. It also means to shout with your voices. But it seems like the context here, what we're talking about, is kinds of shofar blasts. So that just seems to be part of the, you know, the pomp and circumstance. This is really, it's hard to imagine what this was like. Even when we have seders with other people, it's, you know, a fairly small affair. But this is like a huge pomp and circumstance affair, hundreds of people packing into the temple with shofars and everything. So, and it's going to get even more fancy in a second. HaKohanim omadim shurot shurot, ubideihem bazikei chesef ubazikei zahav, shura shekula kesef kesef, shura shekula zahav zahav, v'lo hayu ma'oravin. The priests stood in rows. Some of them had in their hands silver bowls, and some of them had golden bowls, but the rows never mixed together. There was a row of silver and a row of gold and a row of silver and a row of gold. There was no row of part silver and part gold. Presumably, again, to just heighten the drama and the circumstance here. Yeah, Joe, so you can see the Pesach being sacrificed still today by the Samaritans. I don't know whether they're doing it now, I mean, in the current circumstances, but in general, they do continue to sacrifice the Pesach on Harag Museum. I don't know if they allow visitors anymore, but there are pictures of this online. It's obviously less crowded as this and less pomp and circumstance, but still, you can sort of get a sense of what the temple service was like just from the Samaritans. Okay. V'lo hayu labazikin shulayim, shema yanichum v'yikrash hadam. They also, the bowls, this is just a nice little side note, the bowls didn't have flat surfaces. In order that they wouldn't put the bowls down and forget about them, and the blood would congeal before they had a chance to sprinkle it. So sprinkling is a important part of the sacrificial process. So you want to make sure that there's no chance of the blood congealing, so that you can't sprinkle. That seems to be the situation here. So they're nice little like round bowls, so they couldn't stay there. Okay, Mishnah 6 continues along. Shachat Yisrael v'kibel hakohen notzno lachaviro lachaviro lachaviro. So unlike most sacrifices have to be slaughtered by the priest, the Pesach can be sacrificed by a regular lay Jew. It seems, one again, the reason could be practical. There were just far too many Korban Pesachs for the Kohanim to actually sacrifice themselves. So they needed to open it up to other people. It also, I think, goes together with the sort of hybrid home temple status of Pesach that we've seen already a few times show up. So it's a home thing, in the home ritual, in the sense that a person can do it even if they go to the temple. It's a temple ritual, as we're about to see, because they would so the Jew would slaughter it, the lay Jew would slaughter it, and then the Kohen would receive the blood, and then the Kohen would sort of pass it along an assembly line, pass the blood in the bowl along an assembly line. And then they would receive the full bowl, and they would take it all the way to the altar, and then they would bring it back empty, so be refilled with new blood. And the kohen hakarov etel hamizbeach zorko srika achat keneged hayesod. And the way the sprinkling worked is that whatever kohen was closest to the mizbeach at the time would do one sprinkling, then against the base of the altar. A lot of sprinklings are on the corners of the altar, or you do it like four times or seven times, like if you've been to the Yom Kippur Avodah service, there's a whole thing about the number of sprinkles, achat v'achat, achat v'shtayim. So here it seems to be just one big sprinkle goes to the bottom of the mizbeach, the altar. Okay, so that was the procedure for one of these groups. But then the group leaves. Yatzda chat harishona v'nichnasa chat hashniya. The first group left and the second group would come in. And so too for the second group. The second group would eventually leave, and then the third group would come in. Just as the first was done for the first group, the exact same procedure would be repeated for the second and third groups. And also, while this was going on, if the gold and silver wasn't enough, and the shofar blast was not enough, we also have Karu et Hahalel. The Levites would recite the Hallel during this whole process. So one of the things that ancient visitors to the temple remark about is how silent it was. And it was silent apart from the music of the Levites. So here is, think about it as well, all this background music. So with instruments. So they would recite the Hallel the whole time. Im gamaru shanu v'im shanu shileshu. if they finished going through Halal once, they would do it again, they would repeat it. And if they finished it twice, they would do it a third time, even though it actually never happened that there were enough sacrifices for them to do it three times, or like the courtyard was not big enough to hold a group of people that they would have to do the Halal three times. But the point being that they would just keep, in theory, they would keep doing Halal until everyone was done, and they would just repeat over and over again. Rabbi Yehuda Omer, Mi'amea shalachat hashlishit lo higyu lahavti ki yishma Adonai mipnei she'ama mu'atin. Rabbi Huda clarifies and says, actually, the groups got smaller as they went through. So presumably, you know, if you wanted to get into the earliest group possible. So a lot of people packed into group one, a lot of people packed into group two. But the last group was so small that in the entire existence of the third group, they did not get halfway through Halal. 114, maybe? Because the people were too small. So they, even though they might repeat it, so even, and that was in the first time. So even like the third group, they never even finished the whole Halal. But for the first two groups, they maybe sang it twice or maybe once, just to give you a sense of numbers. So yeah, how many Israelites participate in absolute numbers? How many reach division? Yeah, it's a good question. Various scholars have tried to make estimates about it. It's very hard to know. I know that one person who tried to make an estimate is E.P. Sanders, who wrote a book about common Judaism, where he's trying to sort of assess, basically acknowledging the fact that our texts necessarily come from an elite group. And so he's trying to sort of uncover what actual Jews thought and did. And so he does some of this statistics. But yeah, you could sort of use this as an estimate in some ways. You could like try to guess how long they took to sing the Halal. You could like roughly work it out. And then you could like work out how long it would take and how many priests there were, and like you could probably do some kind of estimate here, but it's hard, it's very, very hard to know. Okay, but I assume it was packed basically all the time, except for the third group apparently. Continues on, and now we're talking about how it played out on Shabbat versus when the 14th fell on a weekday. K'maseu v'chol, kach maseu v'shabbat. They would actually do exactly the same procedure, it would be exactly the same, except. So apparently the way that the priests would clean the temple courtyard of all the blood is that they had this sort of flowing river, and they would stop up the river, and then the river would then, once it stopped up, would sort of flood the whole courtyard automatically and wash away all the blood. They would do that on a general weekday, and they would also do it on Shabbat. The priests would wash the courtyard without the... we'll get to the cooking the lamb in a second, without the agreement of the sages, whoever the sages are here. They would do that, but people were not necessarily happy about it. If people the sages preferred that they would not have done that, and they would not have cleaned the courtyard on Shabbat, I assume probably because it's a thing that could just be done on Sunday. Like, you don't need to do it right then. You could wait, but the Kohanim, I guess, felt that, you know, everything that was part of the Pesach ceremony was so important that it would be overriding what they normally might not do on Shabbat. Rabbi Huda Omer, Kos hayam male midam hatarovet, zarko zrika achat, al gabe hamizbeach, v'lo hodu lo chachamim. And by the way, this situation of washing the courtyard, it seems to be true regardless of whether it was Pesach or not. It seems like they would wash the courtyard every day, including on Shabbat, throughout the year. And Rabbi Huda comes along and adds and says they actually had a cup which they filled with the mixed blood at the end of the day when they had like the courtyard was covered in blood. They would like pick up a bit of it, fill a cup of it, and they would use that to sort of just sprinkle on the mizbeah, on the altar. But I think the theory seems to be is like maybe there was a sacrifice during the day which which wasn't sprinkled properly, or wasn't sprinkled at all. So this is, Rabbi Huda thinks there's a way to just sort of catch all the sprinkles that they missed by getting the mixture of all the blood. So there must be some blood from that sacrifice in it, and then like doing one last sprinkle at the end of the day. It's a bit like doing like the catch up baruchu at the end of shul, where like people who come for Mariv and they missed the beginning baruch, sometimes shuls do a second baruch at the end. So it's like just try and catch all of the missed sprinkles. Rabbi Huda thinks you can do that. This actually is pretty consistent with Rabbi Huda's opinion. He in Zvachim, animal blood, but yeah, I'm sure it is hell hazard. And he and Zvachim thinks that ein dam mevatel dam, that blood doesn't nullify other blood. So he thinks that this mixture of blood maintains the status of each individual sacrifice and the blood of the animal which was mixed into it. But the majority opinion goes against him. They do not agree with Rabbi Yehuda. It seems to be because they think, what do you mean? It's just blood. How do you know that there's any amount of that blood sacrifice left? Like, you're just sprinkling blood that has nothing to do with sacrifice. It's just very bizarre. So that's just about the sort of the process of cleaning the temple courtyard. Okay, moving on to the next stage, which we're getting closer to the cooking. Because the first thing you need to do before you cook is to flay the animals and get rid of the skin. I hope no one's squeamish, by the way, or vegetarian for these Mishnah. Okay, Ketzad Tolin Umafshitin. How would they hang up and hang out to dry in order to drain the blood a bit and to flay the skins of the Pesachs? It seems again that the point of this is that there is actually just too many people to use the normal method, which they're about to explain. Unklayot shel barzel hayu kvuim baktalim uva'amudim shebahen tolim mafshitim. There were little hooks, iron hooks, that were fixed in the walls and the pillars, and that's where they sort of hung up the meat and took the skin off. But when you run out of hooks, which seems to happen on Pesach, because it's too packed, v'chol mi she'in lo makom nitlot ulahafshit, maklot dakim chalakim hayushan umaniach al ketifo v'al ketef chaveiro v'talo mafshit. What they would do instead is they would leave these, anyone who didn't have a place to hang and to flay, they would there were left sort of wooden staves, fine wooden staves, they were left there in the courtyard so that people could use them. They pick them up, they sort of put them on their shoulder and on the shoulder of somebody else, and they hang the animal in between the two people and flay the animal there. So they had a backup plan for when all the hooks got used up. I'm sure it was a rush to the hooks. But that's a problem because you might think that the wooden staves are mukta on Shabbat, that they are not available to you. And therefore, Rabbi Eliezer says they had a different practice on Shabbat. Rabbi Eliezer Omer, Arba'asar shechaliot b'Shabbat, manich yado al ketef chaviro v'yad chaviro al ketefo, v'tola umafshit. They would forego the staves if the 14th fell on Shabbat, so they would just put their hands on each other's shoulders and hang the animal from their arms. It sounds pretty painful and a bit gross, but there you go. Gemara thinks that there was a majority opinion against Rabbi Eliezer. His opinion does not carry much weight here. But it's also hard to imagine when, like, everyone knew how to flay animals and how to, like, prepare animals like that. It's also hard for us to imagine. The last Mishnah here, and this is what I teased you about. There's some framework in which this makes sense. Okay, so this is Kara'o V'Hotzi Emurav Nutano B'Magis V'Hiktiran Al Gabei Hamizbe. Why flay into the skin? It's just a technical term, but I could be wrong. It does sound worse, but I think it's just a technical term for removing the skin. Okay, so he would tear it open, and after the flaying, right now you can get access to the flesh, tear it open and take out the emurim, which are the some kind of fats that you would have to burn on the altar. And you would put it on a tray, and they would turn into incense on the altar. So they would take the parts of the fat that have to be burnt on the altar and burn them on the altar with a tray. Okay, that's all fine. Yatzdachat rishona v'yashvala bahar habayit. When the first group would leave, and it would sit on the temple mount, so it would leave the temple area, and they'd go to somewhere nearby to the temple mount. The shnia would hang out b'chel in the place called the chel, which is a little bit closer to the temple. It's between the partition and the wall of the women's courtyard, so it's not exactly in the main courtyard, but it's sort of close to the main courtyard. And v'hashlishit b'mkoma omedet, and the third group would remain in its place. Now, I don't think this means literally omedet, as in they literally stood, as opposed to the others who are sitting. I think it just means they remained there. So they stayed in the temple courtyard. Now we're going to explain. Okay, we'll do the last line of the mission, then I'll go back and explain this. Hashecha, once it got dark, yatzu v'tzalu et pisteihen. They would go and roast their Pesach offerings when it got dark. So this is where I was saying that you need extra words in order to understand what's going on. It seems like the commentators generally think of this Mishnah as happening specifically on Shabbat. That it was only on Shabbat when the first group would go sit on Har HaBayit, and then the second group would sit at the Chael, and the third group would just remain in the temple. And then, because they couldn't roast it yet on, because it was still Shabbat, so they had to wait for Shabbat to go out before they could go home and roast their offerings, their Paschal lambs. So yes, that makes sense, could be what the Mishnah means, but it doesn't say that. So you'd have to argue something like this Mishnah is maybe in the wrong place, maybe it belongs somewhere else where they were talking about the difference between Shabbat and Chol, because it could be above pretty easily. It has also nothing to do with the first clause in the Mishnah, which is about the fats that you burn on the altar. So yeah, so maybe this is also what they did on Chol, that they would wait, but I don't know if that's true. I just wanted to point out what you need to know in order to understand it, according to the commentators, which is that this is specifically the procedure on Shabbat. Otherwise, everyone would just go home straight away and to get extra time to roast their lambs. Yes, so you said, presumably that person, the requisite skills, the representative. It's true, though, I think family units may also have come to the temple in a certain way, like a group, a group of people could have come all registered for the same Pesach. And also, I don't want to understate how much basically every single person knew how to flay an animal. That was chapter 5. We're going to go into chapter 6. We also ended with this sort of, if the interpretation I just gave of that Mishnah is correct, and we have a situation where it was specifically on Shabbat, and we've already talked about the washing of the temple floors on Shabbat versus non-Shabbat. Now we're going to move to chapter 6, which is main topic at the beginning here, is to what parts of Pesach you can do on Shabbat and what parts you can't. Where did the lambs come from? People brought them from home. Or goats, by the way. The Paschal lamb is normally what we call it, but actually a goat is also totally valid as a Pesach sacrifice. So in other words, chapter 5, so it was basically just about the logistics of the Pesach offering in general. And now we're going to talk about the kinds of things that you could do on Shabbat or not. Chag Gadya, very nice. By the way, if anyone can explain to me the meaning of Chag Gadya, I will happily take it. Eilu dvarim b'Pesach dochin et haShabbat. Here are the things which on Pesach would override Shabbat. So dochin means literally to push away. This means, in other words, things that would otherwise be forbidden to do on Shabbat, you can sort of push away the Shabbat restrictions in order to do it anyway, Pesach. And here are the things which you can do for the Pesach, even on Shabbat. Shechitato uzrikat damo umichui kravav vehekter chalavav. Aval tzliato vahadachat kravav einan dochin. The things you can do is you can do the slaughter of the lamb, which normally you would not be allowed to slaughter an animal on Shabbat. You can sprinkle the blood, which also you wouldn't do for this kind of sacrifice on Shabbat. You can wash the innards of the entrails, and you can turn the fat into incense. Those are all the things, the parts of the Pesach sacrifice that you could do on Shabbat, which is basically the things that happened in the could have happened clear in the temple precincts. Though some of the rest could be also happen in the temple precincts, as I will probably come up later. But the roasting of the lamb and the washing of the innards do not doche the Shabbat, presumably because you could just wait until the end of Shabbat and do it, and it wouldn't be such a pain. It wouldn't be such a big deal. You could just wait an hour or two, and then you would be able to do it. And this explains why we've... So this is actually sort of... We've seen this before. We've seen that these things... We've been talking about how they sacrificed on Shabbat this whole time. So this is not new information. What it is sort of a nicely packaged piece of information, which we can sort of hold together. It's just a nice way, a succinct way of expressing all of the information here. Okay, other things that you can't do on Shabbat. Harkavto v'havato michutz latchum v'chatichat yabalto ein dochin at Shabbat. You're carrying it and bringing it outside the Shabbat border, and cutting off defects, what kind of wart, those things you can't do on Shabbat. Rabbi Eliezer says, you actually can. Basically, he thinks that once something is involved in the Pesach sacrifice, Rabbi Eliezer seems to think you can just do it, right? He thinks that only, basically, that the first opinion seems to be that only things necessary, strictly necessary to carry out the offering that would otherwise break Shabbat, you can do on Shabbat. Rabbi Eliezer seems to think that you can eat, once something is involved in the Pesach sacrifice, you can just do it. It doesn't really matter. Shabbat shalom.